start off by giving my heartfelt thanks to Mark and Stephanie and the Global Labor Research Center for inviting me to speak today. And thank you so much to all of you for coming out on this winter day to come here this discussion. I appreciate your interest in engaging with what I think is a really important issue facing migrant workers and precarious work in Canada. As you know, over the last... Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Okay. If my voice fades, can you please let me know? It's an oddly shaped room, so I think the acoustics might not be great, and there's no batteries in the microphone. So you'll have to rely on me speaking loudly if I can. So do just wave if it fades. As you know, the sort of conditions that migrant workers are facing in Canada has been all over the news for the last year and for the last couple of years, but particularly earlier this year. And that is, I think, a good thing, that we're having a more open public discussion about what are the circumstances in which labor migration are happening, what are the conditions that migrant workers are facing, what do we think about it as members of these communities. But however much our public discussion about migrant labor has deepened over the past couple of years, the issue of recruitment is one that remains very largely in the shadows. And yet this is the key point. This is the point where some of the most egregious abuses of migrant workers are taking place. Recruitment is where it all starts, obviously, for migrant workers. It's where they enter into what I've called the labor migration cycle. And it's the point in that cycle where the power imbalance between workers on the one hand and recruiters and employers, on the other hand, is at its greatest. It's the point at which workers are most ripe for exploitation. It's also, in my view, the most important point in the labor migration cycle, because the conditions under which migrant workers are recruited into labor fundamentally determine whether they will be treated fairly, or whether their rights to decent work and decent lives in Canada will be eroded. But despite how important that is, this is the stage in the labor migration cycle that is least examined. And it's also the stage that has the least effective legal oversight. And so, entering into the research that I've done, I wanted to look at whether we're creating security for workers and our communities, or whether we're creating systems that enable people to profit from migrant workers' precarity, hence the title of the paper. And as you can see, I'm not going to keep you in suspense in terms of what the answer to that question is. Yes, profiting from the precarious is where we stand. In a nutshell, the problem is that oppressive recruitment fees remain absolutely commonplace. They are the norm. Recruiters are also able to leverage conditions that are imposed through the federal labor migration programs in order to extract even more profit from workers beyond mere fees. And our complaint-based laws are failing to provide meaningful protection. Complaint-based meaning that there's no enforcement unless an individual migrant worker comes forward and files a formal application with the regulatory body. But while all of this sounds really grim, I think we're also at a moment in time where we have an opportunity to make a shift. One of the key things is that the legislation that's been in effect in Ontario that allegedly prohibits recruitment fees has been in place since 2009. It was introduced in 2009, became effective in the spring of 2010. And so we now have a track record to see how that legislation has been working. We can do some evidence-based analysis of it. The other thing is that across Canada, we have a number of different models that have been adopted to address the problem of exploitation and recruitment, and we also have experience from those other jurisdictions that we can draw on to see what works and what doesn't. And as I've said, we've had an increase in the level of public education around around migrant worker issues. And so I think that we have the capacity to actually deepen that conversation, to make it more nuanced and complex. What I want to do today is I want to take you through this information in three separate passes. With each pass, I want to add some layers to deepen our understanding of what the social problem is, to move us past those really shop-worn phrases of unscrupulous recruiters and exorbitant fees. Those phrases, they just get trotted out like mantras. They've lost their meaning, if they ever had any, but they are also words that end up distancing us from what are the real experiences that people are having. So I want us to dig underneath what that actually means so we can talk constructively about how to move forward. So the three passes that I want to take you through are quickly just a snapshot of where we're at now. The second pass, I'll take you through it again to give you a more nuanced understanding of what the experience of recruitment looks like from the perspective of migrant workers and why the existing laws are falling short for them. And then I want to look at the alternative models that are based on international and domestic best practices. Before I begin that, just to give you some framing on this, I've been working on this material for about 2 years. The data that's in the report is original research that was done over an 18-month period, that the experiences that I've reported are based on interviews and surveys with migrant workers in Toronto and Southern Ontario. There's in-depth one-on-one interviews, focus group meetings, surveys, interviews with community-based organizations that are working directly with migrant workers, interviews with community organizers in workers' countries of origin to talk about the experience on that end. I've spoken with recruiters, I've spoken with government officials who are charged with the responsibility for enforcing the legislation. The workers who I've focused on in my research have been low-wage workers who've come in through the Living Caregiver Program, workers who are here through the other low-skill program, the general low-skill program, and the agricultural stream. There is a portion that I address on the seasonal agricultural workers. I'm not really going to say much about them today because they're not subject to private recruitment, and my focus today is on private recruitment, but if you have questions, I can talk about them as well. All of the workers who I interviewed are here with precarious temporary status. All of them spoke only on the condition of anonymity and on the condition that the documents they showed me to verify the practices that they've experienced would not be disclosed. They're tremendously frightened of repercussions for coming forward with the information, whether from the recruiters directly or the risk of being deported. But they are all here with legal status, and that's something that I'll get back to later. Just quickly, as framing, as you'll be familiar with by now, since the year 2000, the population of migrant workers in Canada has more than tripled. These are migrant workers with temporary status. We're up over 340,000 migrant workers with temporary status, which makes them collectively, I think it is now about the 15th largest city in Canada, if you put them all together in one place. The population has more than doubled since the year 2006 alone, and it far outstrips the number of permanent immigrant, economic immigrants who are admitted into Canada each year. So this blue line here is the permanent economic immigrants. What you should know about this line, it's 160,000, is about 54,000 of those are principal applicants who are the economic immigrants. The remainder of that group is spouses and dependents. When you look at this number here, the temporary foreign workers who are present in Canada, that is workers only, no spouses, no dependents. So the gap between those numbers in terms of workers is even greater than it appears on this graph. Those same patterns, the accelerating growth in temporary foreign labor, is replicated at the federal, provincial, and municipal level right across the country. If you look at Toronto itself, migrant labor has increased by 237% since the year 2006. The sharpest increase has been among workers who are brought into work in the so-called lower-skilled jobs. Overall, a quarter of migrant workers are employed in low-wage jobs that are deemed lower skilled, things like caregiving, agriculture, food processing, restaurants, fast food, hospitality, cleaning, tourism, retail, and on and on. It's open to all occupations, and they are being filled in all those different sectors. In Ontario, every year for the last 6 years, between 60 and 67% of positions for migrant workers that have been authorized on labour market opinions, now called labour market impact assessments, have been for workers in low-wage jobs. And as we've seen temporary labour migration explode, along with that, an industry of third-party, for-profit labour recruiters has emerged to match employers and workers to fill the jobs. To be clear, there are reputable recruiters who do this job matching and who legitimately earn their fee from the employers. But what I want to do is focus on the really widespread abuse of low-wage migrant workers at the hands of disreputable recruiters, because that is actually much more common. It's been documented by academic and community-based researchers for years. Oppressive recruitment fees, job promises that turn out to be false, recruiters and employers confiscating passports and work permits, and the law and our public understanding of the significance of all of this has been very slow to catch up. In 2009, after a very high-profile investigative reporting series done by the Toronto Star that documented widespread exploitation of living caregivers by recruiters, Ontario introduced a law called the Employment Protection for Foreign Nationals Act. That legislation was aimed to combat the problem, but the law applied only to living caregivers. It did prohibit recruiters from charging fees. It prohibited employers from recruitment costs from caregivers. And it prohibited recruiters and employers from seizing caregivers' passports and other documents. With my research, what I wanted to do is look at, well, so 4 years out, what's changed? Have things changed? And the answer is no. Since the legislation came into effect, two-thirds of caregivers have paid recruitment fees. So this is after the law came into effect. Most frequently, caregivers are paying $3,500 to $5,000 plus airfare from their country of origin to get caregiving jobs in Ontario. Most of those workers are coming from the Philippines or from Hong Kong, so add a couple of thousand dollars to those recruitment fees, and that's what people are paying. That's the most common. Many caregivers are paying even more, $7,000 to $9,000 plus airfare. The highest recruitment fee paid by a single caregiver who I spoke to was $12,000. After this report came out, I was flooded by calls from other caregivers telling me about what their stories were. Many calls from people paying $15,000, $18,000. The highest fee I heard was $21,000 for that was paid by a caregiver from China. $21,000. As part of my research, I did a Freedom of Information request to the Ministry of Labour asking for absolutely all documentation on the enforcement of this legislation since it came into effect. All documentation, communication, records. What they gave me showed that between 2010, when the law came into effect, and 2013, a grand total, cumulative total of illegal recruitment fees recovered across the entire province, $12,100. As of October last year, there were only 8 investigations ongoing. So, as you can see, the gap between the promise of the law and the reality is vast. But wait, there's more. As you'll recall, the legislation applies only to live-in caregivers. And yet low-wage migrant workers across all economic sectors are being targeted by the exact same predatory recruitment practices. It was about 2 weeks ago, the Ontario government passed Bill 18, which would extend this exact legislation to cover all migrant workers in Ontario. But I just want to put an asterisk. They haven't changed anything about the enforcement model. All they've done is said that it now applies to all migrant workers, not just live-in caregivers. We see how well it's working for live-in caregivers, so I'm not holding my breath. But what you should see is that the caregivers were actually better off than the other folks. What you typically see for low-wage migrant workers in Ontario is that the not caregivers, other than caregivers, typically they're paying $4,000 to $10,000, although it can be as high as $15,000, and again, sometimes more. What we also know is that these fees are on the rise. So this is just one example. These are fees charged to Filipino workers in the food processing industry going into the exact same factory. In 2008, they were charged $3,750. In 2013, they were charged $7,000 for the exact same job. For all these migrant workers who've been coming into the province for the past decade and more, total recovery, $0, wholly outside the protection of the law. So despite the law, we know that workers are continuing to pay recruitment fees. They're continuing to borrow money from recruiters and from informal money lenders to pay those fees. And they continue to sign over the deeds to their homes to secure the loans. They continue to be charged oppressive interest rates, rates that are on average 8% per month on the money that they borrow to pay these fees. These practices effectively place workers into debt bondage to their employers and recruiters. We know that these migrant workers continue to be recruited into the province only to discover that the jobs they were promised don't exist, which forces them to work without status in order to pay off the debts that they incurred to get here. And they continue to have their passports and work permits and travel documents seized, trapping them in abusive employment relationships. That's the snapshot. What I want to do is take you through it a second time, go through a second pass, to look at what does this really mean to migrant workers. Because the exploitation does not begin and end with the payment of fees. We need to really understand where the cycle starts and also to look at how the federal and provincial regulation of labor migration intersects and contributes to a very toxic mix that facilitates these sort of relationships that we see. Because recruiters are able to very actively leverage conditions that are imposed by the federal migration programs to more deeply erode the rights of workers in the province. Very briefly, this is material out of my earlier report, Made in Canada, which if you're interested, you can look at in more detail, that looks at both the federal and provincial regulatory schemes. But what we have is a system that is segmented according to class, really. This is an immigration system that's segmented by class, so that professional, managerial, and skilled workers, as you can see, have multiple routes into permanent immigration, permanent status in Canada. Workers in so-called lower-skilled jobs, the ones that were labeled C and D, the national occupation classifications of C and D, have a permanent insecurity. They're allowed in to work on a temporary basis but must exit the country. There has been, as you can see, just a small opportunity for some caregivers to transfer into permanent status. But for the most part, the workers that I'm talking about have no access to permanence in Canada. Conditions that are imposed by the federal migration schemes, it's the federal government that sets the conditions which allow workers to come into the country, but it's the province that's responsible for enforcing their terms and conditions of work when they arrive. And the gap between those two ends up being quite problematic. The federal program, some of the key characteristics that we'll end up talking about later on, are that all the workers who are coming in to do low-wage jobs are arriving on tied permits, which means that they can only work for the employer who's named on the permit, doing the specific job that's named on the permit, in the specific location named on the permit, for the specific period of time on the permit. The other thing is that the migration programs have also, either as a matter of law or as a matter of practice, required workers to live on the property of their employers. So not only is their work permit tied, their housing is either by law tied to the employer or in practice tied to the employer. And we know that that is, in and of itself, regardless of any recruitment fees, a really strong disincentive for workers to enforce their rights, because if they complain about their treatment, they are fired, they lose their jobs, and they lose their homes. This happens regularly. They end up in shelters, or they end up being deported. The other thing is that for the workers, there's a time limit for how long they can be in Canada. So the seasonal agricultural workers who come up from Mexico and Jamaica can only be here for 8 months a year. They're on this perpetual recruitment cycle. But for the other workers, they can be here for up to 4 years, although the federal government has said that period is going to be shortened. What used to happen before June of this year, when the reforms were introduced, was that workers could be here on permits of up to 2 years that could be renewed for a second 2 years. But after 4 years, the migrant worker must leave the country and cannot return to Canada for another 4 years. So it's the four-year-in, four-year-out rule. The federal government has said, with the reforms in June, that workers will now be here on one-year permits rather than two-year permits, and that they're going to shorten the period of time, although how short it's going to be cumulatively, they have not yet announced. Right now, we've got the four-year-in, four-year-out rule. April 1st of 2015 is going to be the first four-year date. The regulations came in 2011, so April 2015 is when the first group of workers is going to be ejected because they've used up their four-year maximum. Many of the workers who I've interviewed and who I've met with over the many years I've been doing this work have been here for 8 years, 10 years, working full-time, full year. But it's the clock started ticking for them in 2011, and all of them will be required to leave in 2015. So that's just the backdrop. So the labor migration cycle has all these elements about your conditions of recruitment, what are the terms of your work permit, what are the conditions of your arrival, living and work in Ontario, what are the conditions of the possibility of renewal of a work permit, expiry, and ejection. A lot of that is structured by what happens, how the federal government has structured the migration streams. And as we go through this pass, you'll see how those create opportunities for exploitation. So, transnational migration, where it all starts. The low-wage migrant workers who are coming into Ontario are arriving from relatively impoverished communities. They are overwhelmingly racialized workers from the global south. They're arriving primarily from impoverished rural communities with very limited opportunities, so economic opportunities. So the workers and their local communities depend very heavily on the remittances from overseas work to sustain those communities. Just to give one example, the largest group of migrant workers in Canada comes from the Philippines. So there's significantly more than the other origin countries. Since 1974, the Philippines has pursued a very aggressive labor export policy, which currently sees thousands of Filipinos every day leaving the country for work overseas. Research has estimated that between one-third and one-half of the Philippines' population is directly dependent on overseas remittances for their survival. And overseas remittances constitute between 8 and 10% of the annual GDP of the Philippines. It's a massive, it's the largest source of foreign currency. So in that context, what you see is the workers who are in Canada, this is not their first step on the migration journey. Many of them have been working outside their country of origin for years, as many as 10 years before they get to Canada. For the live-in caregivers, coming to Canada is tremendously significant because it's the only live-in caregiver program that allows a pathway to permanent residence. And so for workers who have been circulating around the globe from Hong Kong to Saudi to Qatar to wherever, doing migrant caregiving work, coming to Canada is a real draw because there's a chance to get off the merry-go-round and actually establish roots. So that dependence and the significance of Canada's program in that global scheme for them becomes important when you see the capacity, or really the lack of capacity, to enforce rights when people get here. For the other workers, the other than caregivers, who don't have an opportunity to seek permanent residence in Canada, the four-year-in, four-year-out rule means that they are going to continue on that global cycle migrating for work. So there's a real premium while they're here on being able to earn what they can, because they know that they're going to be moving on in a short time. So it's in this context of severely constrained options that an individual collectively, you typically collectively with their family, makes a decision to migrate for work. This is not an individual voluntary choice. It's often a choice. It's a necessity, and it's a decision that's made with the family. The family assesses which member in that family has the best potential to secure work transnationally, looking at the skills they have, their training, their English language capacity, their adaptability and other sort of personal capacities of that member, or because of the gendered options that are available for work. And that's a whole other discussion. But in turn, the migrant workers' remittances support that broader extended family network. As a result, any action that a migrant worker takes in Canada to enforce their rights and to resist exploitative treatment risks their continued employment and directly affects not just the worker, but that entire extended family and community that is dependent on them for employment. And recruiters know this. So coming to recruitment, recruiters very actively use this community dependence on overseas jobs to discipline workers who resist unfair treatment. And what was really heartbreaking as I talked to workers from all around the globe was that their stories were so shockingly similar. Workers from Asia, from Latin America, from all the places that I spoke to, working in completely different communities in Ontario, completely distant, different industries in Ontario, described a very similar practice in which recruiters will deliberately cut off the pipeline to overseas work for the entire community if a worker complains about their treatment. So if you don't pay your fees, if you get uppity about how the employer is treating you, they shut the pipeline down, they move to another rural community down the road where people are just as desperate for work. On the other hand, if a worker is compliant, if they pay their fees, if they don't make a fuss with their employer, their relatives will be put forward by the recruiter for subsequent jobs, right? So it's the carrot and the stick, but it's very consciously and deliberately exercised by recruiters as a means to discipline workers. So what does the recruiter supply chain look like? There's such a wide array of different folks who are engaged in recruitment. Some of them are huge multinational corporations with offices in Canada, offices overseas. Sometimes it's someone with a phone here who has connections in another country. It can be that informal, but it fills the gamut in between. The most the most direct recruitment, obviously, is the employer hiring a worker directly. But you can have a recruiter in Canada, you can have a recruiter overseas, you can have one here, one there, or multiple in between. And often what you have are quite extended supply chains where there'll be a recruiter in a large city who has sub-agents and helpers in broader rural communities who feed workers into the center and then ultimately across seas. What I saw in my research is the wide range of different corporate arrangements around recruitment, but also where the payments happen. Oftentimes, what you hear in the policy discourse is this is a problem that's happening overseas. This isn't a Canadian problem. We can't do anything about what happens in workers' source countries. And it's true that sometimes workers do pay the fees to recruiters in their home country before they leave. Sometimes they're paying money directly to the recruiter in Canada. Sometimes they'll pay a few installments back home and subsequent installments after they arrive. There is no clear division. With the where there are organizations operating in both countries, the money may be paid at the office overseas, but then transferred internally through the recruitment business to the recruiter in Canada. So we should not be too quick to wash our hands of this. What's important to know is that, I think it's valuable to look at the nature and the length of the recruitment chain that we have, because it lets us see what are the opportunities. And what you know is that regardless of which of these arrangements a worker is coming into Canada through, one end of that pipeline is inevitably in the country of origin, but one end of the pipeline is always here in Canada. And that is the leverage that, if we take enforcement seriously, that is the opportunity to get in and disrupt this chain. When we look at the supply chains that we have, it's important to ask whether the regulatory models that we've adopted facilitate a chain of deniability in which Canadian-based recruiters and employers can disavow any responsibility of the actions of their helpers. Are we contributing to the problem by making it invisible, or are we bringing abuses to light? And in this respect, it's valuable to reflect on the lessons that we've learned from reforming sweatshops in the garment trade in the early 20th century. As Bruce Goldstein has written, the origins of the sweatshop are in labor contracting. And as with present-day recruiters of transnational migrant workers, labor contractors compete on price, and then directly and through subcontractors sweat the profit out of the workers. In the garment trade, that's done by lowering pay, employing child labor, reducing safety and environmental standards. In the transnational migration context, it's done through recruitment fees, interest, and rent. And the response in the garment industry, both historically and currently, in the wake of, particularly in the wake of the Rana Plaza factory collapse, the response has been to impose accountability up the supply chain to the ultimate employer. And this is why it's important to recognize that one end of that pipeline, the employer, is always in Canada. Yeah. Exorbitant fees. I hate that word. I hate that phrase so much, because it just has become meaningless to us. So what does it mean to pay for work? What I did is I asked workers, can you translate this into your home currency? Like, what does this really mean? You're paying $3,500, $5,000, $10,000 in Canadian money for these jobs. But what does that actually mean in your home currencies? And here's what they told me. These are some examples. Just so you know, what I've done in each of these examples is I've taken the lowest rate that workers told me about, not the highest rate. I don't want you to think I'm inflating this. This is the lowest rate. So Guatemalan workers working in agriculture and food processing, they're paying the equivalent of $1,350 at the low end to come to Canada. That's 10,000 quetzal. That represents 6 months, every penny earned over 6 months of labor in their home countries in good jobs, which were not available in their home communities. What they told me is that they would pay 10,000 quetzal, so that's 6 months' labor, just to get into the program. They'd have to pay another 7,000 to get a job. Having paid that much, they're then asked for another 3,000 to get it in order to have the choice of which job they get. So once you've paid in, it's, you know, sunk costs. They keep asking you for more and more and more before they actually deliver the contract to go overseas. But 6 months, $13.50 in Canadian dollars, 6 months of wages in Guatemala. For caregivers coming from Hong Kong, $3,500. Remember, they're also paying airfare on top of that. $3,500 Canadian is $25,000 Hong Kong dollars, and that is equivalent to 1 year's salary. Every penny earned over 1 year of labor in Hong Kong, plus their airfare. For the Filipino workers that I told you about coming into food processing in Ontario, $7,000. That's 295,000 pesos, which is the equivalent of every penny earned over 3 years of labor. So this is a lot of money in Canadian dollars, right? These workers are coming in to do minimum wage jobs in Canada. All of the workers who I interviewed were being paid around minimum wage, which at that point was $10.25. Some of them were being paid less than minimum wage. The highest paid worker was being paid $11.04. Minimum wage is now in Ontario $11 an hour. If you work 40 hours a week, full-time, full year, on $11 an hour, you'll be earning just over $22,000 Canadian. So even in Canadian money, this is a big hit for migrant for minimum wage workers, even bigger hit when you convert it into their currency at home. And as I said, of course, they don't have that kind of money lying around. So what they told me is they can't borrow money from the banks because they don't have anything to back up that kind of a loan, which means that they need to go to illegal informal money lenders who charge them, as I said, outrageous, extortionate interest rates of 8% a month or more. They told me about having to sign over the deed to their house, of having to sign over the deed to their family land that they may be farming, that for their subsistence farming, or to give the recruiter a share of their family, their extended family business. So there's an enormous amount on the line when they pay those fees. People ask me, well, why do they do that? If you don't pay, you don't get the job. It's as simple as that. In order to get into the stream, you have to put up the money. What workers once workers start to earn their Canadian income stream, they really prioritize paying down the debt as quickly as they can because of the interest rates that are constantly ticking up. For the workers whose currencies convert more favorably with the Canadian dollar, some of them were able to clear their debts within 6 months. More typically, it takes 1 to 2 years. 2 years was the average that it took for migrant workers to pay off their recruitment debt, earning Canadian dollars. There were many workers who I ran into who came to Canada, had been promised a 2-year contract, were terminated after just a couple of months. But at that point, they're sent home, but they still owe all this money, and the interest is ticking. So what they were forced to do was to once again enter into the recruitment stream, this time having to take out another loan to pay another recruitment fee, paying even higher interest rates because they've already got one bad debt, to get back on the merry-go-round, to go earn the foreign currency to pay off the debt, and then once the debt is paid off, to be able to support their families. So that is what is behind the phrase exorbitant fees. You can see how that makes workers very reluctant to push back when they're treated improperly by their employers once they arrive. That burden puts them so far behind the capacity to enforce rights to decent work, even arriving on their first day. But, so how does this intersect with the terms and conditions that are imposed by the federal migration programs? The first thing I want to talk about are the tied work permits. This creates a number of opportunities for even greater exploitation. What what I heard from some workers is that they arrive in Canada and their employer will give them an interest-free loan to pay off the recruiter, right? So they'll give them a lump sum to pay off the recruiter, but then they're having to work to pay off that debt to the employer. So they basically are not getting paid until they've worked off their debt. It is straight up indentured labor. Even where employers do that, and some of the workers were quite protective of their employers, saying, well, they were trying to help me out, but they're also completely, it still creates a situation in which that worker is completely tied by law to that employer and owes their employer money. And even for the employers who did this as to be nice to their to the workers, use that as leverage to extract extra labor, right? Like to say, come paint my house this weekend, look after my kids this weekend, all sorts of things that were not part of the job, but the worker feels morally obliged to do it and is, remember, tied to that employer, can't go to any other employer, is tied to their housing. But the bigger problem, other than these interest-free loans, the bigger problem is the power that recruiters have to deliberately place workers out of status, right? This happens so frequently for live-in caregivers that it's a practice that actually has its own name. It's called release on arrival, right? But it doesn't just happen for caregivers. It happens for workers in all the different low-wage streams. I'll use the caregiver example as to walk you through what that actually looks like. What happens is the workers will arrive. They'll arrive at the airport at Pearson. They'll get picked up at the airport by the recruiter. And the recruiter in the car out of the airport will say, here's your termination letter. Or the employer doesn't need you anymore. They've just got off, literally just got off the plane, and are told that they don't have a job. Sometimes there never was a job, right? Sometimes it's been a scam from day one. Sometimes there was an employer, but sometimes there's an individual who puts their name forward, who is paid money by the recruiter to put their name on an LMO, but never had any intention of hiring that worker, but just it's a way to get a worker into the country who is ultimately exploitable. So release on arrival, they're told that they don't have a job to go to. Of course, the recruitment debt doesn't care, it's still ticking, right? The other thing that intersects with that is the tied housing, right? That the employee's housing is tied to the worker, to the employer. But if the employer has terminated them, or if that job never really existed, they're also homeless, right? And the recruiter will then say, oh, come stay with me, right? And so the worker will be taken into the house of the recruiter. Many of them talked about being in the basement, having eight different workers sleeping on mattresses in the basement of the recruiter's house, and they're held there. They are not legally allowed to work for anyone else because they don't have a valid work permit. They don't have housing. Their debt is ticking. And then the recruiter will eventually start sending them out on undocumented jobs. They're desperate to earn some money. They go out and do it. They don't have the money to go back. They don't have a plane ticket to go back. Eventually the recruiter will, for the caregivers, eventually place them into a legitimate job, but then it still takes about 6 months to get all the paperwork in place so that they have a valid work permit, have an LMO, and have a valid work permit. But for that entire period, while they're waiting for their status to be regularized, they're completely undocumented, and they are often paid significantly below minimum wage because the employer and the recruiter know that they have no real recourse to complain about it. If they come forward and complain, they're in breach of their work permit. They will be deported. They're going to go home with that massive debt, with the money lenders chomping at the bit when they get there. The fear that workers have around that debt is enormous, and you need to know that there are physical consequences for their families for failure to pay, right? These are not clean arrangements. There is violence. There are threats of death. There are threats to property. So they need to pay up. So that's how the release on arrival works, where the capacity of the recruiter to put people out of status is very simple, very easily activated. The other thing that I saw was that recruiters are sometimes also employed in Canada as the landlords, the people who arrange housing for migrant workers and who collect the rents. Sometimes they live physically in the building where the migrant workers are housed and stand there on payday and take their checks, right? When the recruiter is also acting as the housing agent, that's another opportunity for them to extract profit, to sweat the profits out. And what it leads to is an incentive to pack as many workers into the housing as possible. So what you see typically are workers in very overcrowded housing. What I saw typically was 8 to 10 workers in a two-bedroom house, 16 workers in a four-bedroom house, cumulatively all paying their cumulative rent significantly above market rent. So this becomes another profit center, both for the employer and for the recruiter. What I saw as well was workers being charged $1,500 or more to renew their work permits. This is something that workers can do directly online for $150, but recruiters were extracting significant profits because the workers didn't have either the English language skills or internet access to be able to do it themselves. With the four-year in, four-year out, as I mentioned, it takes workers about 2 years to clear their debts. And it's only after they've been here for about 2 years that workers get connected up enough with the local community to know what their rights are and to be able to enforce their rights. Once they've cleared their debts, then they can start to assert a little bit more agency, still remembering the dependence at home. But what the four-year-in, four-year-out rule does is it effectively decapitates leadership within the migrant worker community, right? It's only in those last 2 years of their four-year period that migrant workers start to assert their rights, to connect with other workers, to act as mentors and leaders for other migrant workers who have come into the system. But once the four-year period is up, they're out. So there's a continual cycling out of workers and an undermining of collective action. With the federal government shortening the period of work permits and the cumulative period of time that workers are in the country, it puts even greater pressure on workers to do what they need to do to repay the debt so that they can earn some money to send home, but they're going to be gone before they can actually engage in that broader organizing leadership. What we also see is recruiters paying, charging fees to move workers across provincial boundaries and into different programs, either from the living caregiver to the agricultural stream or vice versa, where workers think they might be having better opportunities. So, big question, recruitment or human trafficking? Right now, human trafficking is the sort of sexy topic in terms of where the research money is going, where the attention is going. I find that very problematic. I have very deliberately framed my research around recruitment. The difficulty with human trafficking as a frame for understanding this is that it treats it as an exclusively criminal activity that's individualized and considered aberrant. What you need to know is that every single worker that I spoke to, nearly 200 workers in this study, every single worker was here, properly documented, coming in through the legal pipelines for transnational labor migration in Canada. This is not human smuggling. This is not an illegal activity. This is the regular practice within the legal avenues for temporary migration that we've developed in Canada. And so putting a frame on it that treats it as somehow aberrant is problematic. The law has allowed these practices to be normalized and made invisible. But, you know, having said that, I recognize that migrant workers themselves, many migrant workers, consider the fact that they are being forced to migrate for work, a state failure in which their home states are engaging in trafficking of citizens. I completely appreciate that, and I don't mean to undermine that discourse, but I think for Canada as a destination country, to think of this as something that is aberrant is sticking our heads in the sand. This is happening completely, entirely within the legal channels of migration that we've set up. And are we feeling good about that or not? There's five reasons why the Ontario's model, this complaint-based model for migration recruitment fees and recruitment abuses, doesn't work for migrant workers. The big one is that it's a model that depends on the weakest actor in the system to police compliance with the law. We know that with the employment standards regime, that workers who are in vulnerable situations are not able to enforce their rights. Workers with permanent status in Canada, with citizenship in Canada, typically don't file complaints for employment standards breaches until after they've left that employment and got secure employment elsewhere. Migrant workers don't have that opportunity. So filing a complaint is not a reasonable, a model that's based on them coming forward to file complaints is unrealistic. What we have is a federal government. As I said, the federal government's responsible for letting workers in. Provincial government is responsible for enforcing how rights play out on the ground. Different organizations, there's an information gap. If the provincial agencies do not know where migrant workers are, they can't go out and do proactive enforcement, even if they had the resources to do it, right? If they don't have that information to know where the migrant workers are, they cannot serve in any effective oversight capacity. A second reason it doesn't work, the complaint-based model doesn't actually close the information gap that leads migrant workers into these abusive relationships in the first place. The federal government websites on migration have these warnings that say, beware of fraud, right? But they don't actually do anything to help workers avoid fraud. There's no way for workers to know whether they're dealing with either employers or recruiters. So they end up in these situations and then having to do damage control after the fact. Third fall down with the legislation is that the Act doesn't do anything to relieve the recruitment debt. If you file a complaint against the recruiter or the employer, you still have to pay back the debt, right? And that continues to tick. If you file a complaint and lose your job and your housing, that becomes problematic. Fourth point, the Act places the burden on workers to prove that their rights have been violated. But recruiters, in their practices, have become quite savvy about not providing receipts or providing receipts that do not accurately represent what the monies have been paid for, right? So it becomes very difficult for workers to actually prove the extent of the violations that they're facing. The fifth big thing comes back to that community dependence, that tension between protecting individual worker rights and serving the collective needs of the workers' extended families. And what workers repeatedly do is they put their interests aside in order to send money back to their families. So a complaint-based model does not work. Is there another way? And the answer is yes. There's quite an extensive body of international human rights law and standards setting out what are appropriate practices for transnational migration. There's the UN Convention on the Human Rights of Migrants. There's ILO conventions on employment, recruitment practices and employment agencies. It's set out in much more detail in my report. I know this is microscopic and you can't read it, but it's more there just to so that you can see that there are seven little symbols there that I'm going to take you through. Key principles that come out of that human rights framework for migration are a prohibition on recruitment fees, mandatory licensing and regulation of recruiters, security of workers' property and documents, security from exploitation, registration and supervision of employment contracts, bilateral agreements on recruitment, and multilateral
cooperation. And what we have in Canada is actually the leading best practice for how to do this. It comes out of Manitoba. As someone who comes from Manitoba, I'm really proud of my home province for getting on top of this. But they are actually the gold standard internationally. I've just come back from a meeting at the UN on international recruitment practices, and Manitoba really is the gold standard. Manitoba introduced its legislation a number of years ago, and its model has been picked up in Nova Scotia and Saskatchewan as well. What they have, as in Ontario, there's a complete prohibition on recruitment fees, which is good. But it's the enforcement that backs that up in Manitoba's proactive model that makes a difference. One of the things that's really important to note in Manitoba and Saskatchewan is that the legislation takes seriously that idea that you've got the employer at this end of the pipeline and constraining demand for exploitative employment relationships is how you get into this. What they've done is that they've imposed joint and several liability on the employer for any illegal recruitment fees. So if the employer, if the worker has paid illegal recruitment fees, they can recoup that from the employer. They don't have to chase down the recruiter chain. The employer is independently liable for it, and that is the key to cutting off the demand for exploitative recruitment relationships. No recruitment fees. The next one is mandatory recruiter licensing. In Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Nova Scotia, there's all recruiters must be licensed by the Employment Standards Branch or the Ministry of Immigration. They have individual personal licenses that are non-transferable. They're valid for a time-limited period, so in Manitoba for 1 year. In order to be licensed, the Employment Standards Branch in Manitoba does quite an extensive investigation into the recruiters, including investigation into their supply chain and their finances. Recruiters also, in Nova Scotia and Saskatchewan, in their legislation, also requires disclosure of the full length of the supply chain of recruiters and sub-agents in Canada and overseas, and makes the recruiters liable for any offences committed along that full supply chain. The provinces here post on their provincial websites who are licensed recruiters, so that workers can actually check. They can look it up on the website and say, yeah, that's someone that's legitimate to be dealing with. It closes that information gap. Importantly, along with licensing, in order to be licensed, recruiters have to put up a significant security deposit that's non-refundable, so between $10,000 and $20,000, so that money is available right there immediately if there's a breach. And they have to keep detailed records as well that can be examined by the Employment Standards Branch. Security of property, prohibition on seizing passports and travel documents. Ontario has that as well. There's security from exploitation. The legislation in both Manitoba and Saskatchewan explicitly prohibits a broader range of exploitative conduct, not just fees. So things like producing and distributing false information, misrepresenting employment opportunities, threatening deportation, contacting the migrant worker's family, reprisals or threats. All of those are independent, standalone offenses that a recruiter or employer can be liable for under those provincial models. In all of those provinces, every employer who hires migrant workers must register with the Employment Standards Branch before they can get a federal authorization to hire a migrant worker. In Manitoba, the head of the enforcement meets individually with every employer who applies for registration. They do extensive investigation into that employer's practices in Canada to make sure that with the workers they currently have, they're in complete compliance with employment standards. They will not register them until they are fully in compliance with their domestic workforce. What's important then is because they're registered, the Employment Standards Branch knows where every single migrant worker in the province is working. The employer is required to file contact information for every single migrant worker, to file contracts, to give extended information on the conditions that have been promised. But what's really important along with that is that Manitoba has actually put in the resources, the personnel and the resources, whose sole mandate is to enforce this proactively. What they do is they go out and they do sectoral sweeps. So they will hit every employer in a particular sector at the same time to ensure compliance. They've done that over a number of different sectors. For example, they did one on sushi restaurants in Winnipeg, which is one example. 95% were found to be not in compliance. They forced every single one to come up into compliance before their authorizations would be renewed. And they do that from they go sector by sector and do it. They work very closely with community groups on the ground to provide, who give them tips about where the real big abuses are happening. 50% of their enforcement comes from community tips through unions, from migrant worker organizations, from settlement organizations on the ground. So a really important relationship developing that creates more eyes on the street, right? Through this, they also, what they've told me is that there is capacity under the Manitoba legislation for individual workers to file complaints. 100% of the enforcement of the legislation has come through proactive enforcement. There has not been a single instance of workers coming forward to complain because of all the things I told you about. Proactive enforcement is the only thing that works. Bilateral agreements between the sending, the origin country and the destination country. I throw that out there as an idea that is something that could put more oversight onto it. But you have to know that those bilateral agreements, from the sending country perspectives, are very much about securing market share in the Canadian labour market. They are not about protecting worker rights. So I put an asterisk next to that. Multilateral cooperation, huge, as I said, in Manitoba. Having a connection between community groups, between between the enforcement agencies, that allows for information sharing and multiple avenues of oversight is absolutely critical. So we know there's a better way of doing things, and we know it works. There was a worker I spoke to who from the Philippines who was offered access to work in Canada. He could pay $7,000 to work in Ontario, $8,000 to work in Alberta because there was a small possibility of permanent residence in Alberta, zero to work in Manitoba. And he said, why? Why no fees to work in Manitoba? And they said, because they watch us, because the law doesn't let us charge fees, right? So these things work. There are other ways of doing it, but I think it's a really important opportunity for us to look critically about what does it actually mean? When we hear these stories in the press, what's actually happening behind it? Because this is what drives a really deep insecurity for migrant workers in when they're in Canada. It's a large piece of why they're unable to enforce their rights and why they are so deeply exploitable. So in doing this research, part of it is important to dig into what's happening in this particular part of the labor migration cycle. But I don't mean to suggest in any way that the goal is about cleaning up the recruitment pipeline, that it's just about that. We have to look at what is the system that workers are being recruited into. And so I take this as an opportunity for us to make that discussion more complex and more nuanced. So, sorry to go on for so long, but we've got lots of time for questions, and I'm happy to take any questions you have.
Thank you so much.
Oh, one last bit. You should know, migrant workers aren't just sitting there letting this happen to them. They are organizing on the ground. This is one group of workers that I've worked with, the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. They have, for many years, been running a campaign. No fees for work. So check out their website, check out their hashtag, make it right.
Okay, so I'm going to suggest that we just take 5 minutes. People can, if there's anything left on the table, to get some more refreshment. And if you folks want to come to the table for the questions, you can kind of maybe pull in a bit, and you can just catch your breath. Make sense? So we'll just have 5 minutes to kind of reorganize yourselves, and then we'll have at least a half an hour for question and answers.